Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm, and today I have the entire pleasure and thrill to be talking to David Mitchell, the author most recently of The Bone Clox, very well known to Bookworm listeners, but why should I be vain? Known to the world of readers for Cloud Atlas and Black Swan Green and The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, a wonderful writer who's taken us on a magnificent adventure. Now, David, when people ask you what this one is about, what do you say? How do you tell them?
It's tough. Evolved an elevator pitch that I can lay before you if you wish for it.
Let's experiment. Go ahead.
Okay. It's about the life of its protagonist, who is called Holly Sykes. We meet her at six different stages of her life. Firstly, 1984, when she's a runaway teenage punkette. Secondly, when she's the narrator's brief lover in Switzerland in the early 90s. Thirdly, we meet her when she's a mother of a six-year-old in Brighton in 2004, experienced there through the narrator, who is the father of her child, a character called Ed Brubeck, who's a war reporter just back for this family weekend from the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq. Fourthly, we meet her in the present decade of real time, when she's a rather improbable author of a memoir which narrates some of the events that are described earlier in the book, some of which have a supernatural nature, which leads us to the fifth, which is almost too fantastical to be able to include in my elevator pitch, because I bend the laws of physics and time almost to their point of elasticity. Sixthly, if we can say that, and lastly, we meet her again when she's a grandmother and the guardian of a young ward in the 2040s in the west of Ireland, just as our oil-addicted civilization is going through a near-fatal cold turkey for lack of oil, because the stuff has run out. That's her life. In a sense, it's not quite an ordinary life, but it's a not too far off the beaten track one. However, every decade and every section of the novel, into her life erupts a murderous feud between two circles of semi-immortals, one of which is more or less benign, kind of vegetarian, and the other, however, is decidedly predatory. In this war, we can call it, Holly, in the early stages, in chess terms, nothing more than an insignificant pawn, but by the end of the novel, she's proven to be a decisive weapon. That's the elevator pitch. We're up on top of the Empire State by now.
I congratulate you fully. I'd never be able to do that or even elicit it gradually. The book begins as a character novel. Holly is a terrific character.
Thank you.
But gradually it becomes an adventure. And by the time I was immersed in the famous fifth chapter that you mentioned, my eyes were bugging, my mind was boggled, because we were witnessing, and I'm not giving anything away, nothing that wouldn't be known by the first 20 pages of the book, we're witnessing souls traveling from body to body.
Yes.
Now, I can't help it. I've got to ask you, do you believe in the soul as more than a fictional device?
I don't know, but I do believe in the possibility of the soul as more than a fictional device. I also believe in its novelistic possibilities, which I find delicious. And even the possibility that it's real is enough to provide the solace that I need to do what many of the characters are doing in the book, in a way, to evolve maybe a more fruitful and less scared relationship with mortality.
Yes, because mortality in many ways is the subject of this book. We are humans who will age, and as we age, we grow weaker and dimmer. And both of these horologists and
anchorites,
they do not age, or they don't have to if they don't want to. And they are there as figures of either wisdom or depravity. Well, they're various, sometimes both. And Holly is being pulled between sometimes lust and her desire to hold on to her character, to be herself as fully as she can be Holly.
Yeah.
That's part of what makes her so exciting. Were you feeling as if you were aging? Did that start this book?
Yeah, yes, it did. Yes, it did, Michael. It's just looking in the mirror and realizing one day that this youngish bloke you're used to seeing there is actually no longer there. And there's someone who looks very much like your father. It's not just facial. It's not just about vanity. It's also feeling mortality in your kneecaps and in your lungs and in the breathlessness you feel when you take the stairs instead of the escalator. It's getting closer and closer and closer. Our culture is not very good at handling this or helping us to handle it. If you were an alien anthropologist studying us purely through our TV transmissions, you would conclude that no one on Earth is over 40. Well, I think this is one thing that, art is for. We need a relationship with mortality that's not based on fear. We need a relationship with mortality where death is not the reaper, but a constant companion who walks with you through life and just reminds you when you're about to lose your temper or about to spoil this day through some flaw of your character to not do it, because this day won't be coming back. Hold your tongue, bite it back, say something nice instead, and keep the day on the rails. All of the characters, or at least many of the major characters in the book, are given a kind of they're presented with a sort of a Faustian pact. You can take it and become like one of the anchorites, and your relationship with death will become more negotiable. There's a cost, of course. One of the costs is that you have to have your conscience amputated, because the anchorite's longevity must be paid for by innocent people. And also every 10 or 15 years you have to fake your own death, leave your old life behind and move on before people notice that you're not getting any older. In both a serious and a whimsical way, by looking at these terms of immortality.
But this book seems to explore the boundaries of goodness. Goodness seems to have a viable enemy here. And I literally quailed for the sake of Holly Sykes, because she likes bad men. She does. She, at least we know of three of them, four of them, four rather bad men, men who leave women behind and have left them behind again and again. And we worry about her because it's not just that she likes bad men. When they leave, she is badly hurt. She's not a character who has a very happy rebound. She goes into grief and she runs away. She's a person living on the verge of terrible fear, so the reader wants to rescue her.
Oh, music to my ears. This is great. Yeah. She has a tough skin, but it's not thick. She has a tough, brittle skin.
Yes, but she's developed it. She's taught herself to have it. After the second time, she's not going to take any more guff from any fellow who's going to love and leave. And nevertheless, she does fall in love, and those anchorites seem to do research to find characters who are already morally amputated from good practices. They are going to introduce them to the secrets of immortality only because they already don't care about the people around them, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. They do research into us. You can't offer this to just anybody, especially in this day and age. They have to know that, have to know in advance, in a sense, that they're highly sophisticated headhunters. They have to know in advance that the recruits they are approaching, and they probably have a pool of recruits. Just because you're an anchorite, it doesn't mean that if you catch Ebola, you won't die. It doesn't mean if you get hit by a bus, you won't get killed by it. So they do need to replenish their ranks every few years or decades when a death occurs. Regarding Holly and the men, you could argue she's not the best chooser of men, but she also offers those men a chance of redemption. She offers to show them, she doesn't even know she does this, but she offers to show them the better person that they could be.
I'm talking to David Mitchell, the author of The Bone Clocks, which is published by Random House. I loved reading this book. What are bone clocks, David?
It's a form of disparagement. It is what the anchorites call us. The anchorites, as we've said, don't age, and we do. And it's an in-group name for us mortals whose age, whose time within our allotted life is visible on our faces. From our faces they can tell how much time we've spent of our lives and how much approximately is still to come. You can't do that with the anchorites. So the anchorites are not bone clocks, but you, Michael, me, and most of the people listening to this are bone clocks.
If we are tick, 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 tock, just living in biological time, we're condemned to the human body and its fears, its daily nuisances. Both the anchorites and the horologists, they're people who are loosed from time. They're freed, and they're given the opportunity to do more than register the ordinary wear and tear of the body. In a certain way, the good ones, the horologists, are free to acquire wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, as you say, there's a major difference between them. The horologists do get older. They do experience decay and decrepitude and death, but they also do so in the knowledge that 49 days after their death, they will wake up once again in the body of a sick child who's been close enough to death for the host soul to leave, but not so close that the body becomes uninhabitable for the horologist's souls. So the horologists will take over the vacant body and live that life again and again and again. They don't know why this happens. That might be revealed in a future book, if I can work out why it happens. The anchorites, however, so this is why I call the horologists vegetarians. Their immortality is not costing anybody their lives or their souls, in contrast to the anchorites.
They are carnivores, you say.
They are carnivores. They're sort of soul vampires. they don't age. They stay the age they are when they originally signed on or were inducted into this occult branch of knowledge.
We read through the bone clocks for two-thirds of the book, knowing that there's something more going on, but really arrested with our concern for everyday characters who are being tested for the possibility of joining the alternative ranks of atemporals, they're called. Yes. And our characters, well, don't you feel it? Haven't you felt it all your life that you're being watched and tested with the possibility that you were meant for a special destiny? That's what it's like for the characters here. We're not at first talking about anything speculative or metaphysical. It's the sense that life holds always, that life is more than what we take it to be on a surface level. The book is a suggestion that life is larger than we know.
As usual, we have ventured into very deep waters here, Michael, and I love deep waters, even though I'm sometimes can't touch the bottom. Firstly, do we feel that we're being tested? Do we feel we're being watched by higher powers? People who subscribe to a system of religious belief, yes, that's the whole point. You buy into that. Even in the total absence of proof, we nurture this thing called faith inside us that what our senses are not telling us is nonetheless true. Schizophrenics also buy into a reality that is not so.
But don't readers of novels?
Yeah, yes, yes. That, I see where you're coming from. That, of course, is how art works. If we didn't, then it's what we call, in technical terms, a boring book.
Right.
We need to go through the wardrobe into Narnia, and for that Narnia to feel more real than this recording studio or the room you're in at home where you're reading the book or the bus you're sat on reading it on your e-reader or whatever. Yeah.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with David Mitchell about his new book, The Bone Clocks. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with David Mitchell about his new book, The Bone Clocks, a novel made up of six stories that are connected by one sensitive heroine, a young girl named Holly Sykes. I'm sitting and reading, and I feel like clues are being dropped into the narrative. I see one of the chapter's titles is a line from the song about the Magi. Another character quotes from a T.S. Eliot poem about the journey of the Magi. The sense that we're in the vicinity of a wondrous birth is being made by the narrator. We don't know what to make of it. I won't say we even necessarily know by the book's conclusion, the vastness of the world the book suggests. But certainly, that thrill that we're reading something that can only be revealed in fiction, that only the magic of books between worlds can give us, as you suggest, C.S. Lewis's Narnia books. I might think of the Oz books, but of course, Tolkien. That sense that we could travel into the previously unknown is what I like most about this book.
Thank you. It's one of the things that I that I'm proudest of about it as well. It's risky stuff. It blows up quite easily if you get it wrong. I also took the graver risk of not making the book entirely about it. It's a strange beast. It would have been easier to write had I made it a more conventional beast and essentially made the book about this alternative level of reality exclusively, rather than using 4/6 of the novel as a ground for very slow reveal to be dripped in to the other narratives, which I hope are compelling in their own rights, but they're non-fantastical ones, in preparation for the fifth part, where the fantastical element explodes into life.
Now, what fascinates me about The Bone Clox is that while, as a novelist, you know that you have to jeopardize your characters on a regular basis, but I think as a father of two children, you know that you also have to protect them. Mm. And I think that the novel is, in a way, a war between your warm, instinctual desire to protect children and your novelist's acumen that they have to be threatened in order for the book to maintain its tempo, its speed.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I'm not sure if I can improve on how you just phrased it, Michael. You are right. I'm a dad, and this does alter, to a degree, your relationship with the world, and it somewhat rewires your heart and Darwinian apps that lay dormant until my kids were born get activated. Another of the things a novel is a compendium of human relationships, of mother-daughter, father-daughter, lover-lover, aunt-niece, the parent of a child and the other parent of the child, grandmother, grandchild, and I couldn't have endowed these relationships that are here in the novel with what depth they may have, had I not procreated myself, I suppose.
I think that somehow the movie of Cloud Atlas was a pivotal experience in the writing of this novel, because those directors have actors passing from body to body, from character to character. Mm-hmm. And I think that the movie is somewhat unresolved as a result. What's going on here? It's fascinating, but we don't know how it's going to work out, what will happen next. And I think it sort of gave you the freedom to move between genders, between characters, between ages, and to allow intersections that couldn't have been originally anticipated. A little?
I think you're right. I'd planned Marinus a long time ago. Marinus is the narrator of the fifth section, the fantastical part, and is one of the horologists. She is there in male form as the second lead character in The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, the previous novel, in a male body at the end of the 18th century.
He has been Chinese, other ethnicities as well. Now she's black. It's an extraordinary movement that you've given yourself the liberty to explore.
I feel the film of Cloud Atlas, and actually my conversations with Lana Wachowski, who's, and she's on public record about this, so I don't feel I'm paying any, I'm betraying any confidences, but she's the first transgender person that I've had deep conversations with, well, about anything, about art, but also about gender. I feel the film emboldened me and kind of licensed me and showed me how it looks, which in turn informed me with regards to how I could pull it off, how I could do it on the page, which is my medium. What I loved about the film was how they exploited the medium of film to do what only film can do. There are no actors in books. And I was jealous of the fact that a director gets to work with actors who have fixed faces. The characters don't have those. And so when Jim Broadbent appears in one role, in one body, in one place, the face is still there when he's in a totally different time zone, in a very different body. And this did feed into the horologists. I would agree with that.
Here, the soul is trying on different bodies. And we get to see the continuity of the soul, which is something else I suspect that you believe in. I'm accusing you of believing in the continuity of the soul. Is it a just accusation?
Yes. I desire to believe in the continuity of the soul.
I've been talking with David Mitchell, author most recently of The Bone Clocks, published by Random House. Thank you, David, for joining me.
It's been a very great pleasure, Michael. Thank you, too.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Bone Clocks at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz, substituted today by Theo Mondel at NPR West. Thanks to Jane Parshall and David Sobel, my assistants. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Jonathan Coe is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.